The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers! Oh, it feels good to say those words again, or at least to say them in a context where they are appropriate. Man, did I embarrass myself the other day. Hello, Buglers, I said, and that is the last time I ever do a corporate gig for the British Cornets Players Association. Well, I always thought brass is just brass, John, but it turns out it's like the Sunnies and the Shears all over again, but more so with loud, shiny instruments. So we're back. It's Bugle issue 123, the week beginning Monday, the 16th of August 2010, with me, Andy Zaltzman, live and alive in the festival city of Edinburgh, Scotland, and in New York City, the man who wouldn't be here today if it hadn't been for his parents meeting all those years ago, and who has only made it as far as he has in showbiz because the Big Bang happened at the start of the universe. Upon such slender threads do careers hang. It's John Oliver.
Hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. We are back. Andy, the return of the Bugle. You thought it had gone, boom! It just smashed you in the face. You just got bugled and you don't even know it. Has it been revamped? No. Has it been souped up? No. Is it better than ever? No. It's just back, that's all. Let's put it this way. It was happening, then it stopped for a little bit. Now it's happening again. Let's call it what it is. We're back, baby! Woo!
I'm not sure anyone actually thought we weren't coming back, John, given that we had said pretty specifically we are coming back.
True. How is Edinburgh going, Ant?
Oh, total sellout, John.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, not everyone who's bought a ticket has actually come to
Doesn't matter.
I think a lot of people have just bought tickets to make sure they had a physical memento.
That's not important.
Of the show.
To at least feel like you were there. At least like you were financially invested in its success.
And I think the government fears me, John, so they've actually been bribing and intimidating ticket holders not to come. So
I would not be surprised.
Well done to everyone who has come and stood up to the evil machinery of the state. So.
Andy, over the break, I did a gig in Central Park, an outdoor gig in the summertime in Central Park, something done previously, famously, and better by Simon and Garfunkel. Now, Central Park, the problem is clearly too beautiful for stand-up, Andy. Stand-up thrives in gloomy, low-ceilinged basements with sticky carpets and less than the legally required fire exits. It doesn't suit a backdrop of magically moonlit trees. And an unexpected problem as well was that once the sun goes down in Central Park, any silence is filled with the noise of crickets. Actual crickets. And that can be extremely distracting due to the fact it's like every comedian's nightmare, Andy. Whenever a joke went down badly, you're literally greeted with the sound of crickets. My favourite memory from the gig, though, was watching Rob Riggle, who was on before me, uttering the words at one point. Remember, I'll quote here, remember, a monkey can rip your dick clean off. And watching those words just floats elegantly through the trees into the distance. I'm not going to give you any context for that sentence, Andy, because to be honest, it wouldn't really make any difference. And it barely has one. The point is that trees that had heard the sound of silence angelically echoing through their branches were suddenly swimming in the sentence, remember, a monkey can rip your dick clean off. And I do hope there were some tourists or perhaps young parents taking their baby out for a late-night summer stroll whose ears were suddenly greeted with that sentence in the breeze and who had to check themselves for a moment saying, was that, hold on, did someone just, no, surely not. I mean, why would someone say that, let alone remind people of that? And why would it be projected loudly through this idyllic summer night? I must be hearing things. There's no way that someone just compelled me to remember that a monkey could rip my dick clean off. That didn't happen. Let's go home, darling. I think I'm coming down with something.
Maybe it was a crossword clue, was it?
Maybe that was it.
And did you have any put-downs for the crickets, John?
Yeah, I just told them, you know, I didn't come down to where they worked and, you know, rubbed my legs together to emit an irritating sound.
Did that shut them up?
No, it didn't, no. It just emboldened them.
so often the way with hecklers. So thank you to all those buglers who have come to my show so far, and a curse upon the houses of those who haven't. And I don't care what continent or continents you claim you inconveniently live on, that's no f***ing excuse.
Wow, that's harsh, Andy.
Hang on, actually, no, that is one excuse. That is one excuse. Mm. And particular thanks to the man who came on Wednesday, who after the show told me that he used to listen whilst working for an aid organisation in Darfur. So it's always humbling to meet someone who actually does a proper job. Yeah. But also, John, I think we can realise that, you know, 3 years ago there was no bugle in the world, right, and there was a very nasty war in Darfur. Now there is a bugle, and everything's fine.
Well, everything's fine. Wow, that was sweeping,
yeah.
Andy. I mean,
yeah, it was. I mean,
I think I'd ask that aid worker whether everything was fine in Darfur.
I did ask him, and he said, no, it's not.
Like, right.
Has it got better? And he said, not really. So.
Right.
But, you know, if you read the news, it's fine. Or at least it's not in the news. That counts as fine.
That's right.
Isn't that the way it works?
That's the default setting, yeah.
$4.20 at the stand. And as always, some sections of the Bugle are going straight in the bin. This week, an archaeology section, including the Acropolis, epicentre of ancient European history, or cheap 1970s forgery. You decide. And how realistic is Caesar's Palace? After new documents reveal that Julius Caesar might have been to Las Vegas on his stag weekend, could Caesar's Palace actually be an ancient Roman building? Plus, how to turn your garden into a full-scale archaeological dig. Firstly, stock up with some artifacts, buy some nice antiques, a few big ceramic pots, some human skeletons, and some bits of stick that look like they might have been used to help in human sacrifices, and maybe a grail, and bury them all in your garden, preferably while skull-crumblingly drunk so you can't remember where or indeed what the artifacts are. To get some adequate artifacts, eBay or charity shops will do. For higher quality, buy some off a black market artifact dealer or a grave robber. Or for top-notch stuff, ram-raid your local museum. Then simply wait for a few years for your artifacts to weigh, age and weather a little underground, and then start digging. If you have archaeologically minded young children, what better way to deliver their Christmas presents than in the form of a full-scale archaeological dig? So much better to carefully dig them out using small trowels than simply and boringly rip off some cheap, shiny paper. And also, in the archaeology section, what to do if you find a pyramid? A three-step guide. 1. Notify your parents. 2. Check that the pyramid is not a mountain. Such confusions hindered the career of the famous Franco-Swiss Egyptologist Marcelin de Reblochon, who claimed that Switzerland had hundreds of pharaohs and that they had all been absolutely massive. And 3, do not enter the pyramid without mosquito repellents. Most standard over-the-counter mosquito repellents also repel ancient curses, most of which are, of course, carried by mosquitoes, the secretaries of evil themselves.
Top story this week. Britain tightens its belt and immediately considers buying bigger trousers. Andy, Britain has finally had to accept that it has to do something about the size of its budget deficit. Why? Because Britain's budget deficit is fat, Andy. It's not just that the current economy makes it look fat, it is fat. Fat with a PH and with 3 capital Fs. It's f***ing fat. How fat exactly? Try £149 billion fat. That is undeniably overweight. In fact, it's morbidly economically obese, so much so that Britain is about to go on a fiscal diet. Reducing a deficit is very much like losing weight. You don't want to do it too quickly, or you'll just pile it all straight back on, but you have to be committed to it and not go secretly binging on defence spending in the middle of the night when you think no one's looking. And you can't cheat either and go stand next to Greece's deficit just to make yours feel thinner.
Yeah, we are tightening our belts, John, and we are tightening them around the neck of public spending whilst kicking the chair of social justice from underneath its twitching feet. So, yeah, we all need a little bit of austerity now and then. I've not had a lot in my life, to be honest. The closest I've come to austerity was when I was only allowed one armband on a sponsored swim as a kid. One width turned into a 28-hour marathon as I swam round and round in circles. But to be fair, over the years, John, successive governments... we've not really faced up to the truth of our public spending. Successive governments have spoon-fed us so much sugar to make the economy go down that Britain has now developed weapons-grade diabetes. But I've been doing my bit here in Edinburgh, John. I've actually cut 25%, which is what the government's going to cut 25% off, off public spending. I've cut 25% of the best jokes of my show out. So
that's very, very good, Andy.
Yeah, well, the show's nowhere near as funny as it should be, but that is for valid satirical reasons.
But it is going to be a painful diet, this, and just like any diet, it's not going to be any fun for Britain at all. People need to be convinced also that this is actually going to work and that the country is one day going to be standing triumphantly on a billboard somewhere, proudly holding out our fat pants from our waist, showing just how much budget deficit we've lost, and doing long testimonials at the World Economic Forum about how we feel centuries younger now and that any country can do it if you just believe in yourselves. But how are people reacting to the first round of cuts there, Andy?
Well, with I think Justified Terror generally, yeah. John. But I think the government's plan is to cut absolutely everything.
Right.
On the grounds that we don't really need anything these days from the government.
Right. I mean, right.
We don't need schools. You know, in the age of Wikipedia, schools are obsolete.
Take Britain off the grid.
Yeah,
that's
we don't need the health service, John. There are too many people in the world as it is, and you know, I think in many ways, we don't need pensions. We need to be disincentivising longevity, not financially rewarding it. Government also closing down or stopping a lot of playground building schemes, and this is part of a scaling back of all playtime for children, and there will be jail terms for kids caught playing hopscotch. Marbles.
Listen, they've got to contribute too, Andy. It's their future, not ours.
That's right.
That's the thing. Everyone knew this was coming, these cutbacks, but it definitely doesn't make them any easier to stomach. Just last month, the British government abolished the UK Film Council, the Health Protection Agency, and dozens of other groups that regulate, advise, and distribute money in the arts, healthcare, industry, and other areas. The aim is that by shrinking down to its bare bones, the government can cut expenditures by $130 billion. Over the next 5 years. It is said to be the longest, deepest, sustained period of cuts to public services spending since World War II. And at least then, Andy, we knew we were funding the mother of all fireworks displays. We were getting some pretty loud bangs for our devalued bucks back then. People in England are already seriously feeling the pinch, but the truth is that this is just fiscal foreplay, getting everyone ready for the real budget banging that's going to be taking place in October. Because when the government issues its next long-term budget, analysts have estimated that around 600,000 public sector jobs could be lost nationwide. That is terrible. We may be looking at the future of huge public sector strikes. Even the chief executive of the UK Supreme Court said she did not know whether it would be able to function at all if its budget were cut by the proposed 40%. So we may have no Supreme Court, which might work out well, because as you mentioned, it'll mean there's no court to deal with the numerous lawsuits that are going to come from the fact that thousands of planned playground upgrades in England are being immediately frozen, mean that little Timmy is going to get halfway down the slide before plummeting headfirst into the ground.
Well, I mean, you know, it's quite a major thing, the cutbacks that are affecting the already beleaguered criminal justice system, and I guess it's all part of an efficiency drive, because, you know, law courts are pretty inefficient, and surely it's time now for us to embrace either mob justice, which is pretty efficient but often wrong, or trial by media, which is even more efficient and usually wrong.
Yeah.
So, I think you can pretty much get the results by the time the newspapers come out the following day. And why would three tabloid newspaper editors know any less about justice than 12 randomly selected members of the public?
Exactly.
You know, these are all perfectly legitimate cutbacks. Also, I believe the government are long-term looking to phase out women and old people and children. Right. And I guess that's what you can expect from a largely male cabinet. That's just the way it goes. A lot of people pretty queasy about George the Human Chainsaw Osborne's gross-out slasher budget that is either going to save Britain from becoming Albania or make it become Albania, depending on your view of these things. They did actually warn us of this, John. They said, I think we talked about this on the Bugle before, they had an advert just before the election basically lying and trying to terrify people about what would happen if there was a hung parliament after the election. And one of the things they said was that a hung parliament would bring the British economy to its knees. And looking at this cuts programme, at last we have some politicians who are trying to make good on their pre-election promises. Let's cut them some slack, John. That's all I say.
It does seem that the government are now only one step away from insisting that 75% of the British population go into hibernation and don't come out again until the spring of 2015. Also, the problem is, of course, Britain still has to host an Olympics in 2 years, and perhaps it's time that someone suggests a full austerity Olympics. The athletes' village will be replaced by an athletes' campsite, and all the swimming events can take place in the river. And finally, instead of gold, silver and bronze, the medals will be copper, tin and cardboard. Still, Andy, this is Britain. Let's remember that. There is nothing that the Brits cannot handle stoically. We invented the stiff upper lip. We survived the Blitz with the rallying cry of keep calm and carry on. In other words, just ignore the Gestapo. They're merely showing off. There is nothing that could break our resolve and make us lose our collective cool. apart from Prime Minister David Cameron cracking down on low-cost alcohol in supermarkets. Unfortunately, that is exactly what he's doing. And I fear that he could end up in Trafalgar Square next week with his head on a spike. I'm not even saying that he's wrong. Something clearly has to be done about Britain's attitude towards alcohol. And David Cameron wants to stop people, as he puts it, preloading and getting off their heads on cheap shop-bought alcohol, going on to say that action is needed to stop Britain's town and city centres resembling the Wild West. Difference being, of course, that the Wild West is looked back upon with a romantic tinge, whereas Britain's town centres on weekends cannot conjure up any image other than just people vomiting into bins.
And of course, all that behaviour that Cameron has just described, if you put it in black tie and a bow tie, it basically becomes the Bullingdon Club, which, of course, is what he was in at Oxford.
But apparently he's backing Greater Manchester Council's plans to bring in minimum prices through bylaws that state each unit of alcohol must cost at least 50 pence. It's all eminently sensible, but Britain is wound pretty tight at the moment, and he may be suggesting taking away the one thing that people use to paper over their misery. Think of Britain as buckaroo. The British public have had a lot placed on their plastic donkeys' backs recently. Healthcare cuts, education cuts, high inflation, budget freezes. And this final little burden of alcohol increases may just make that donkey go f***ing crazy.
You do slightly feel that the government are not very far away from just coming out and saying, oh, come on, everyone, there's more important things in life than money. Let's all just go outside and play.
Well, America is taking a different approach with its budget deficit, and it's clear that Obama disagrees with the so-called savage austerity measures that Cameron is going with. He even wrote to Cameron last month warning against premature cuts in government spending that might drive the world into a double-dip recession. That must have been a lovely letter to receive. No, how's your summer, David? No, sorry about the World Cup. Just, hey, Dave, don't f*** us all over, please. Love, Barry. Instead, America's technique is going to be to put off doing anything about the deficit until, you know, soon. You know, soonish. It was very hard to find a silver lining in this enormous news cloud. But I'm happy to say it was not completely impossible, Andy. Here is the bright side. Apparently, the new austerity measures are also going to cut the budgets for a number of laws and practices that civil liberties groups in the UK deemed intrusive, including 28-day detention orders for people suspected of terrorism, national ID cards, and the wide use by the police of an elaborate network of closed-circuit television cameras. All gone. Not because it was the right thing to do, Andy, but because it was all too expensive. So when civil rights groups said, we can't afford to curtail people's civil liberties, they were actually talking literally.
Government also cutting back on disability benefits, which was a good thing. I think they're just financially incentivising people to miraculously get better. Basically, exactly what Jesus did, but without making quite such a public display of themselves. And so 25%, this is the aim. We might even go up to 40%. But already it's the least attractive 25% off everything offer since the famous TV dog handler Barbara Woodhouse started selling her new range of three-legged puppies. And I guess the key is going to be whether they cut the right 25%. I'm not sure this will happen, John, because George Osborne, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, famously inexperienced at the top level, and also he's got a bit of previous with this, because when he was younger, not a lot of people know this, he had quite a bad weight problem. And he joined a Weight Watchers group, and one week he turned up and said, hey, everyone, I've lost 25% of my body weight. And everyone gave him a round of applause and said, oh, yeah, well done, George, that's fantastic. How did you do that? And then he just picked up a sports bag, put it on the table, unzipped it, and tipped it up, and outspilled 25% of all his internal organs and one of his legs. So I guess it shows that he can cut, but not necessarily the right things. And then he just said, ow, it hurts when I breathe.
Well, that's what's going to happen for the next 5 years in England, Andy. It is going to hurt when people breathe.
And some of the cuts are easier than others, like the ID cards that you mentioned that were already being cut. So I don't know. Does that count as saving that money twice if you just say you're going to cut it again?
Double save.
Yeah. But is this fair, John? I mean, you look back to Karl Marx, famously said, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. That was in his Communist Manifesto, of course.
Yeah.
In between the other bits of the Communist Manifesto that people don't quote so much, such as a bit about parading tanks through Red Square and pumping athletes full of steroids.
It's all there. It's all there.
I think, in Britain, particularly for conservative Britain, I think the Conservatives generally view the welfare state and public services as the kind of institutionalised compassion that really, like vegetarianism, crop tops, Mohicans and writing poetry, you should probably grow out of when you leave home. One of the problems is, John, it comes down to our general antipathy towards paying tax in this country. And the reason for this is we're just not introduced to it young enough.
Yes,
and,
true.
Because, you know, we're not brought up with the idea of paying tax, so it comes as a nasty shock when we reach adulthood. And I've written to the government and suggested a new tax for kids initiative, in which there will be a special collecting frog in every sweet shop in the country into whose mouths children have to put 22% of their packets of sweets. And if they buy one of those bigger bags of sweets, they have to put in the higher rates of 40% of their sweets. But if they buy enough sweets, they can just shove them all into a rucksack and walk straight out, no questions asked. Mm-hmm. It just weans them onto the way the tax system works.
It's like picking up a language, Andy. Picking up that system is easier when you're younger.
And picking up that bit of 8-year-old material.
It's dusting it off.
Yeah, been a while, eh?
Dusting it off, Andy. Excavating it, like in your early archaeology section there.
Classic 2002 Zaltzman.
Dusting it off delicately with a toothbrush.
Bearing in mind that only about 400 people saw my show that year over 4 weeks, I reckon it's safe.
Meltdown at 15 feet news now. Andy, in times like these, the world turns to heroes. And luckily this week it found another. An instant American hero emerged. An outlaw in the mould of a modern-day Jesse James. What happened, if you haven't already heard by now, was this. As a plane taxied towards its gates, a JetBlue air steward got into an argument with a passenger who was trying to get her oversized luggage out of the overhead storage before the seatbelt sign was switched off. This woman had already smashed him in the head with the bag at the start of the flight. He snapped, grabbed the intercom phone and said something along the lines of, "To the f***ing asshole who told me to f*** off, it's been a good 28 years, I've had it, that's it." He then grabbed two beers from the fridge, opened one of them, activated the emergency exit, released the inflatable slide, threw his two bags down before diving after them, running across the tarmac to his car in the parking lot and driving straight home, where the police later found him mid-coitus with his boyfriend. Boom. He instantly captured the hearts of America. What a story. Although he's now facing up to 7 years in jail for reckless endangerment and trespassing, the public response to this has been outstanding. The next day he had 125,000 friends on Facebook, and someone had already started a Stephen Slater defence fund that had raised a few thousand dollars. His release from jail, after a mystery donor posted the $2,500 bail, was a media circus. He got into a silvery van outside the gates, but two producers from Good Morning America, who were making an aggressive play for the first interview, followed him in, rode along for a block before he kicked them out, but then the driver then apparently suddenly freaked out amid the media circus and kicked him out too. Well, it gets better and better.
Well, that's fantastic, John. I mean, we've all done the same.
Yeah.
Haven't we? No, not exactly the same, clearly. But I've done the same at gigs when I got sworn at by an audience member.
Right.
And was lucky I always take an emergency inflatable escape slide to my gig. But obviously, given that it wasn't an aeroplane, I had to inflate it manually, by which time the moment had rather passed.
Oh, no. God, those are crucially frustrating moments, aren't they?
Can you hang on there, please? Well, it sounds like he melted down like a dead zebra's ice cream there, John. Sounds like he lost it like Britain lost its empire, stroppily after years of build-up. Sounds like he went off the handle more than a man who had just binge-eaten 108 handles in a row in one sitting.
Everything he has said since the event has been gold, Andy. In the New York Times, he said that, apparently, I quote again, "Telling a passenger off via intercom and exiting an aircraft via giant inflatable slide had been my secret fantasy for as long as I've worked in the airline hospitality. For 20 years, he went on to say, I'd thought about it, but you never think you're actually going to do it. But he did, Andy. He dreamt it and he did it. And I think it's pretty clear from the public response that America dreamed of someone one day doing that too."
Maybe that's what Martin Luther King was talking about.
That's right. If only he'd lived to see his dream come true. Newspapers found many warnings online of this one day happening. Apparently, in postings on airline message boards, he'd long complained of ridiculous baggage policies and ensuing passenger bad behaviour. One of his postings said, "We got a break after 9/11. In fact, despite the challenges of those events, it became so much easier to fly for those of us who still had jobs with the more stringent enforcement of policies. Now it is again a free-for-all." So there you go, Andy. The nine-year search for something positive to come out of 9/11 is over. Carry-on baggage was temporarily reduced, easing the workload on air stewards. I wonder if it's going to take another 9 years to find a second positive outcome. Stephen Slater is expected to do a slew of interviews over the next week to sate the public thirst for their hero. And apparently ad companies are also in discussions over using him. But beer endorsements apparently were the first natural suggestions. In fact, you know, you could easily do a quick commercial of him telling passengers to go fuck themselves before cracking open a frosty Bud Light and sliding down the inflatable slide straight into a disco on the runway. And it's just an idea. But also, one marketing consultant even suggested that JetBlue themselves should now make him their spokesman, saying, "Steve Slater is the modern-day equivalent of Charles Bronson in Death Wish." Except, of course, there's no artillery, bloodshed or permanent damage in this particular example of brand vigilantism. The only problem with that analogy is that the only recognisable qualities of Charles Bronson in Death Wish are artillery, bloodshed and permanent damage. Without those, it's just a movie about an angry man in a moustache.
Weren't you in a band called Artillery, Bloodshed,
yes,
and Permanent,
yes,
Damage?
Yes, I was. That's why it really chimed with me, that quote. The consultant went on to say, "I'd recommend JetBlue gets behind him. They have the kind of brand personality and authentic self-assuredness to use this as a perfect opportunity to demonstrate purpose and conviction. And if not, then I'd recommend one of their competitors snap him up." That is clearly unlikely at the moment because JetBlue has singularly failed to find any of this remotely amusing. Releasing a statement just this morning saying, "The most distressing aspect of the media coverage has been the lightness with which they're treating the deployment of the emergency slide. Slides can be as dangerous as a gun." What? What slide is more dangerous than a gun, Andy? What the f*** are they talking about? That's even stupider than the whole pen is mightier than the sword thing. I tell you what, JetBlue, I'm willing to settle this argument with you with an old-fashioned duel. I will meet you in Central Park tomorrow morning at dawn. I will bring an AK-47. You can bring your stupid slide. Let's do this!
Well, of course, I mean, a lot of people think that JFK wasn't killed by Lee Harvey Oswald, but by a kid on a slide coming down the grassy knoll. At breakneck speed.
Where was that, Oliver Stone?
Yeah.
Where was that? There's no... But the problem is there, Andy, it all quickly gets out of hand. Oh, well, was it, you know, was that kid working alone? Were there two slides? Was there a water slide involved that no one knows about? It's true that Steve Slater is now the acceptable face of rebellion in America. He has been a lightning rod for everyone who's either wanted to tell someone to off or who's wanted to have a go on an inflatable slide. And I would suggest that he bypasses all these commercial ideas, Andy, for movie franchise. He can be the modern day Dirty Harry, except instead of walking around killing people, he just tells them to go f*** themselves.
And then goes down an inflatable slide.
Yes. Feature section now, Islamic architecture. This week, the Western world has been arguing that there's a time and a place for Islamic architecture. The time is 1,000 years ago and the place is not here. But if you look past the casual racism and then the formal racism, there are some very interesting buildings in the works at the moment. The most spectacular is a new clock being built atop the Royal Mecca Clock Tower in Mecca, Saudi Arabia. It started ticking yesterday to mark the beginning of the month of Ramadan. And to put it mildly, it makes Big Ben look like cute Ben, or even embarrassingly tiny Ben, or even where's Ben? Let's go straight to the clock's vital statistics. The clock has four faces that are 151 feet in diameter and will be illuminated by 2 million LED lights, along with a huge Arabic script reading in the name of Allah. when a glittering spire is added, topped with a crescent to symbolise Islam, the edifice will stand at nearly 2,000 feet, making it the world's second tallest building. Residents of Mecca will also be reminded that it's time to pray when 21,000 green and white lights, visible at a distance of 18 miles, flash five times a day. There's no other way of saying it, Andy. That clock is pimped out!
Well, it's good, though, because I was just looking at a clock the other day in my flat, and I was thinking, that'd be so much better if it was 2,000 feet higher up and flashing five times daily.
Here's the problem, though. Islamic scholars would like it to take over from the Greenwich Observatory and become the new GMT. No f***ing way, Andy. We got there first. We invented time. We'll be the ones to tell people exactly what time it is. And how wrong they want to be about that, it is an hourly decision left up to them. Arabian time, for instance, is just 3 hours wrong, which, understandably, must be frustrating for them. So close. I can see that.
It's closer than your lot, John. You Americans.
Yeah.
What, 5 to 8 hours out? That's pathetic. Absolutely pathetic. The French are much closer than you. That must sting. That must really sting, yeah, stateside.
It does hurt. It definitely does hurt.
There's an Egyptian cleric has claimed that Mecca has a greater claim to be the prime meridian than Greenwich because it is, quote, in perfect alignment with the magnetic north.
Right.
But other time scientists have challenged this. And some American scientists have claimed that the magnetic North Pole is, in fact, in perfect alignment with Canada, the United States and Mexico.
Really?
So that's... I didn't know you could get quite so patriotic about the meridian.
Yeah.
Out of all the things to argue about in the world, just let that go.
It's a flashpoint, Andy. But what one of the Islamic scholars said regarding the magnetic line, that's why, he said, if someone travels to Mecca or lives there, he lives longer, is healthier, and is less affected by the Earth's gravity. He said, that means you can basically fly if you live in Mecca. He said...
Have you ever seen a basketball game there? It is awesome.
They get some serious air. He said, you get charged with energy. What? Have they never been to Greenwich, Andy? There is nothing more uplifting than sitting in a park in Greenwich under grey, rainy skies, eating a subpar sandwich. You want to talk about energy? Munch on a soggy cheese and pickle while standing on true time. It's clear that there's only one reasonable way to settle this, Andy. Prolonged holy war. I can't see any other way around it.
There have been wars fought about a lot less, John, recently as well.
Now, obviously, that is a joke. But the problem with a story like this, Andy...
Is it, John?
Or more specifically...
Many a true thing said in jest,
true,
my friend.
True. Or more specifically, reading a story like this online is making the mistake of scrolling down into the comment section below the story by mistake. Because that is a Pandora's box of bigotry. In fact, I really, truly believe that comments pages on news stories should have a warning so that you don't scroll down too far. Something should flash up instantly saying, attention, this article has ended, reason stops here. What follows is a thunderdome of bullshit. Venture forward at your own risk. Godspeed. Because... essentially, beneath this story was just a lot of comments about how if Muslims around the world like that clock so much, maybe they should all go and live there in Muslimistan. It was a variation on a theme of that, a jazz improvisation of hatred.
Well, it's unsurprising. Even now, just everything becomes an act of hostility between the Western civilization and the Islamic civilization. And I guess when you look at our history of interference and betrayal, you realise we haven't so much... burnt our bridges with the Muslim world. We have totally incinerated those bridges, drunk too much at their funeral, urinated into the urn, and scattered the now soggy ashes all over the Middle East.
Another Islamic building which has been getting people's knickers in a completely unnecessary twist is a proposed...
It's been pretty much plaiting those knickers,
yeah,
hasn't it?
Yeah, oh, very much so. It's been in a weave. It's a proposed Islamic community centre 2 blocks away from Ground Zero. Now, there are a number of reasons why this knicker twisting is pointless. Firstly, because this is a fairly open and shut case of freedom of religion, a fundamental constitutional right upon which America was based. And I'm sure the Queen is sitting on her beanbag in Buckingham Palace at the moment, chuckling to herself and saying, well, 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 America, how's that freedom of religion working out for you? You know, the principle for which you were so eager to leave Mother England? Well, it looks like America's chickens have come home to roost, and now you're all covered in chicken shit. One argument the Conservatives are making here is that it's disrespectful to build upon such hallowed ground. Disrespectful? Have they been to downtown New York? It is a swamp of sleaze. There's a strip club, just one block away from the site. And as for the respectful plans for Ground Zero, they're going to build an enormous office block for Condé Nast on it. Freedom of religion is one of the great unshakable ideas America was built on, yet Conservatives here seem to have the argument now that now is not the time to be exercising the freedoms they hate us for.
Edinburgh Festival news now, and, well, delighted to be able to announce the Bugle Awards for the top comedy show in Edinburgh. Won this year by Andy Zaltzman for his fantastic show at The Stand.
Well done, Andy.
4:20 every day. And the runner-up is Political Animal, hosted by very promising young comedian called Andy Zaltzman.
Well done again,
Midnight
Andy.
At The Stand, Monday to Thursday.
Congratulations.
I can also recommend a couple of theatre productions. Randy, Peter and the Harem of Wenches. By William Shakespeare, from a recently discovered early 17th century manuscript found in a Jacobean latrine latrine pit in London, rumoured to be the play that Shakespeare famously dropped down the John just as he was about to take it to his agent. If it is verified as a genuine Shakespeare John, it would be by some distance Shakespeare's bluest play, containing a string of profanities as Randy Peter gets thrown out of a succession of nightclubs, before deciding to set up his own strip joint. And so far, so different for Shakespeare, but then, oh, guess what? It only turns out that one of the dancers is his long-lost sister, and another one is his long-lost twin brother after a sex change. Yawn. I can also recommend Stalin and the Turnip. That's pretty self-explanatory. And Waiting for Godot 2. Well, you have to ask, has the Samuel Beckett Foundation sold out by selling the rights to the Godot franchise? Find out in this all-action sequel, set in the brutal badlands of downtown Mexico City, as three rival drug gangs fight for control of the city. Thought to have the highest ever body count for a Beckett play, and the most swearing.
I just got to chip in there, Andy. I'm not sure Stalin and the Turnip is quite as self-explanatory as you think it is. Is that a ventriloquism act?
I just thought I'd just leave that floating out there, John.
Just Stalin and a puppet turnip.
Sports news now, and it brings me no joy to say this, John, but since we last talked on the Bugle, the World Cup's finished.
Andy, I don't believe that is true yet.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid it is true, and finished quite a long time ago now as well. To be honest, it was pretty shit. But at least the right team won, John. Spain.
Yes.
In after one of the most dirty football matches of modern vintage, the final with a frankly reprehensible Dutch team. Leading the way for Holland, of course, was the midfielder Mark van Bommel. And as always in the aftermath of big sports events, books get rushed out. And I just bought actually the diary of Mark van Bommel today, and I thought I'd show you one of the entries. This is from just before the Dutch team flew out to the World Cup.
Great,
Today I woke up. I excitedly looked in the mirror, but my hopes were swiftly dashed when I was still clearly Mark van Bommel. I kicked my basin, then raked my studs down the side of my bathtub. I then brushed my teeth with my new electronic toothbrush, which I had specially made. It has a little replica football boot on the end, and when you switch it on, the boot repeatedly kicks your teeth and gums until they're clean. Helped me psych up for the day ahead. I went downstairs for breakfast, scything my two-year-old daughter down as I went, before running away before my wife could tell me off. I walked into the kitchen, elbowed the coffee machine right on its cappuccino frother. That had to hurt. Then poured some cornflakes into a bowl. I put the bowl on the floor, then clattered into it from behind, studs raised, shattering the bowl and sending the cornflakes flying all over the kitchen floor. Yum, I said to myself, the perfect breakfast. Darling, I shouted to my wife, I'll just take the dog for a walk. I wouldn't do that, replied my wife a little angrily. He snapped two Achilles tendons and did his knee ligaments after you walked him yesterday. Come on, I hit back, I was going for the ball. Rover hobbled past me, growling. F*** you, I muttered at him, surreptitiously treading with my full weight on his bandaged rear left paw. I'm Mark van Bommel.
Well,
what a read.
Very good read. Very good read. The Dutch really were incredible, Andy. Paul and I were talking about it before, and you know, this, I think, just as Zidane was the abiding memory of the previous World Cup, I think my abiding memory of the last World Cup final will be Xabi Alonso getting kicked in the heart. Kicked in the heart. Unbelievable.
That means it. I mean, it's now. It would have been 12 years by the time of the next World Cup final that there was last a World Cup final in which someone didn't get kicked in the chest.
Yeah.
With, or yeah, hit in the chest with a bit of someone else that wasn't supposed to be there.
It's true.
So that's it for this week, Buglers. Thank you very much for listening. It's been a pleasure talking to you again after a month or more away. We'll be back again next week. Do keep your emails coming into thebugle@timesonline.co.uk. There's more bullshit on the Bugle Twitter feed at Hello Buglers. And I will see you all in my Edinburgh show. All of you. All of you. Or my vengeance will be deadly. Don't laugh at that, John.
These people
have had it too easy too long.
Sorry, Andy.
That's a lot of vendettas I'm going to have to pursue.
Yeah, it's quite a body count. Bye!